And it so happened that I gave a talk to a conference on Sankara some time back to neuroscientists. So, and I made some a presentation which I sent to everybody, and I just I just copied some of the slides which are relevant to the talk today, and I gave you them as well. So, avidya, ignorance, we can look at it as illusion. That means not seeing the way things really are, and the way things seem to be. And the way things seem to be, they seem to be existing as a constructed world. Now, right this minute, things seem to be constructed. We are sitting opposite each other, we all have a name, we remember each other. At least most of you do. I don't remember anybody. I remember people, but I don't remember names. So, but more or less we remember. And we think we know what's happening right now. We think we know that this is a room, and this is me, and this is the world, and this. But if we look at it with another eye, it's not quite like that. So reality is not something that we can say we know. It's a construction that we make. And the construction, avidya, not seeing, is that we are driven by greed, hate and delusion, by the survival instinct. The survival instinct makes us construct a world like this. And we can't do anything about it. It's happening when we're from the age of zero, when we build a world. You can't say to a kid, I can't say to my grandchildren, stop, it's avidya, you're constructing the world. The child has to construct the world. Why? Because karma works like that. So the world is a construction. We can't say it isn't. The construction is constructed. But if we see like world like that and we stay with that, then we're in the world of avidya. So there is an invitation to see through the constructed world. So this is also part of karma, it's part of our potential. So both together, we are constructed by karma, and we can't say stop as a child, don't. And yet, karma also provides us with freedom, with the possibility of freedom and liberation. They're together. So sankharas are, you can call them patterns, tavniyot. You can call them, I like to call them engravings. I think that it's quite a good image. It's something that harut, it's engraved, it's like constructed in our being. And I think modern science has quite a good view of this, because you know, science talks about neural networks of brain connections. So in other words, when we see a tree, we are the actual network in the mind is tree. There is a network in the mind of cells of a ta'e moach that connect to each other, and the tree is there inside the network. And then when we look outside, we see something, we refer to the network says it looks kind of tree-like, I remember this, and the network says this is triggered tree, and so we say, oh, that's a tree. If it's a little bit off tree, we're not sure about it, then the network goes back, there's a feedback, and says, well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it fits the tree model that I have in. So in other words, we have in our brain engravings or objects engraved in networks of cells. And this is another way of looking at sankhara. And I remember why I'm telling the story of tree, because of my mother. When she had Alzheimer, and I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again. And we went to Switzerland walking, and she had in the middle of her disease, and so she really didn't have much memory, but she loved to walk in Switzerland, so I took her on a holiday. And we were walking in the middle of like millions of pine trees, I'd say oren, and every minute she would stop opposite a tree, a pine tree, and say, "Wow, I've never seen anything like this before in my life." And it's as if she had no neural networks. The sankharas weren't really working because the memory had dissected, dissolved them. So every tree was new and fresh. And it was quite extraordinary, this sort of middle class Jewish Orthodox lady turning to be so childlike. And then sometimes she'd see a tree that was knocked down by lightning or fell down, and she would cry tears. She'd say, "Oh, look how sad this tree has fallen down." So we have neural networks, and they are constructed, and the world is constructed or by us, in us, through our memory, through patterns, through recognition, through identification, havchanot. We know tree to be tree, we know this to be this, we know self, me to be me. And it's based on habits and patterns and engravings. The image in the tradition is of a potter. Sankharas are the image of sankharas in the traditional icon that is both Tibetan and also Theravadan is a potter. So a pot, cheres, or kadarut. It's a pot, and someone has made a pot out of clay, out of this, out of water, and so on, and the pot feels constructed. But the image is of a potter making a pot. It's clearly compounded. There's the potter, there's the action, there's the pot, there's the earth. It's very clear in this picture, and I gave you, there's a picture, you'll see it there as one of the pictures, it's on the bottom of the page. That's one of the classic ways that it's depicted. But it's this one. Here he is making a pot, but there's the mountain behind, there's the world behind, right? It's a compounded thing. The point is, as again neurologists or brain science will tell you, that these constructions are transparent. Namely, they are built without us being able to see that they're built. We actually don't see that we're constructing the world. We don't see that we're making a tree because it's transparent. We don't see that we are a self, that we're making ourselves as a self, because we see through it. It's taken as assumed. We don't see the process where we build the world. We just build it. It becomes automatic. And that's why it's a problem for us. That's why we suffer. Because we keep building the world as a construction, and then we stuck with it. The world doesn't fit our constructions. We construct the world, but the world doesn't fit that. The world is not fixed by our constructions, and that's why there is dukkha. Because the world is constantly changing and moving, and it doesn't fit the construction we put on it. We make sankharas. For example, I'm alive is a sankhara. I exist. We assume we exist. We don't know that we're doing it. We don't know that we're making a self. And when we die, life comes and kills us, And we don't understand it, and we don't want it, and we rage against it, and we suffer from it, and the whole life is busy trying to stop death. And we don't see that the whole construction of a lived being that doesn't want to die is a construction. It's not in life, this construction. It's something that we put on life as a kind of a stunts or a pattern, saying, I exist, me, here I am. This tree exists. I know what it is. I know me. I know the world. So this is the basis of suffering, is that our illusions don't fit life. Life is constantly changing, mysterious, not fitting our stunts, our patterns, our sankharas. I'll give you an example. Conflict is a good example. Especially with the rocket falling last night. We're in conflict with somebody or someone. And the conflict seems very, very real. It feels very real. There is an other who is threatening us. We feel the fear, the anger, and the rejection. We get into a very strong duality. I protect myself, the other is against me. The duality is really strong. We push the other away, and then we suffer. How did I get into this conflict? I'm a Dharma person also. We suffer even more because we feel we shouldn't be in conflict because we're Dharma people after all, so we suffer double. But we do. And the fixation in there, based on fear, protection, our shirion, and which seems real, protect myself, the self that we protect seems real, the other is the enemy seems real, the threat seems real, the way we look at the other person seems very real, the way we label, they give tavit, the enemy, Gaza, whatever the enemy is, people there seem very real, etc., etc. It's very frozen. But if we begin to look at it with eye of wisdom and not eye of avidya, we see this moment of conflict actually is totally open. This other person that is against us may not be against us, maybe conditions that are million conditions creating this moment. This moment is totally fresh and new. We don't really know what's going on. We don't know what it means to protect ourselves. We don't need to go there. We can have many other options apart from our shirion, our haganatiyut, our defensiveness. We can have many, many options in this moment. There is compassion. There is looking in the eyes of the other person. There is a hug instead of an embrace instead of a hit. There is a connection that we can establish that is different from separation. There is non-labeling. There is a moment of complete, fresh, new moment in this moment of conflict. We'll see what happens. Let's open it instead of close it. So, here's the two directions of avidya and vidya. Building the sankhara, sustaining the sankhara, of defense, of me against the world, sustaining it, or dissolving it. You see the difference? Another very simple one. I mean, if you look at any narrative that's in our mind, any narrative that goes through our mind, we can do the same with any, such as self-labeling. I'm no good, I need to struggle in life, I have to be better, I have to achieve something. This is an example of a narrative based on judgment and based on comparing. Others are better than me, I have to get there. For example, it's a narrative. Or we're stuck in the narrative, which is a sankhara, or we open it and say, what's this narrative? Well, it's just a narrative. It's just something passing through. It's full of potential. It doesn't have to be controlling at all, and there's millions of other narratives that I'm not paying attention to because I'm so busy with this one. There's a completely opposite narratives as well. Or there's no narratives, which I'm not paying attention. I've let this narrative dominate the field, up on the bama, on the stage, and controlling me. That's sankhara, tendency. It's based on tendencies. So another way of looking at sankhara is in the word of imprinting, which is a biology word that when I was studying biology I used to use it all the time. Imprinting, that the world is printed imprinted in us in a very early age, and then we think, you know, science has shown it to us. I mean, here's a picture that you also in your thing, that all we know is electrical impulses in the brain. We actually don't know the world. The imprinting says this is the world, but we don't know what the world is. Nobody can tell you what the world is. The philosophers have tried thousands of years. Nobody can tell you what the world is. All we know is that we see the world in the way we do, and it feels automatic, and it feels like the world is what it is. But we don't know. It's just in the brain. We see what we want to see. We don't see reality. There's a picture of Plato's cave, which you can have a look at. It's very similar. Plato got there in a sort of more philosophical way, but he got to the same point, that that all we see here is you, me, sitting here in the cave, okay, and seeing shadows. The allegory of the cave is that all we see is shadows. We see things that are shadows of reality. We don't know what reality is. They are projected into our field of awareness. Here they're projected against through a fire, a light, which you could say is the light of wisdom. Plato called it the light of insight or thought, or pure thought, whatever. I'm not a philosopher, so. But anyway, the point I think is still the same, that there is a fire, which is light, which is not things, it's just light. And we only see the reflection of this light in shadows. The Buddha said, in this 2 meter long body, with its perceptions and thoughts, I proclaim the world to be. It's a very famous quote, but people don't pay attention to this quote. In this 2 meter long body, with its perceptions and thoughts, I proclaim the world to be. Likewise, the origin of the world and the ending of the world, and likewise the way leading to the ending of the world. It's a really powerful quote. It means the world is in us. There is no world that we can know. The world is us. We are making the world. We make the world. The world is here. And the origin of the world, right? And the ending of the world, namely liberation, end of the world as we know it, and the way leading to the end of the world, the Eightfold Path. So, what we have against this is some intuition in some, and this is, if you like, the Buddha nature in us. We have some intuition that that's not the end of the story. A child that's growing up at the same time not only is discovering the world, kilu discovering the world, which we are now saying or rephrasing as making the world. It's not discovering the world that exists, it's making the world based on the karma of what happened before. But the child is also facing, in play and so on, is facing the unknown. We are also facing the unknown. We're afraid of dying because, but we are dying at the same time because it's unknown. We're afraid of the unknown, but we are touching the unknown. We're afraid of it because it's unknown. The fact that we are facing the unknown is our Buddha nature. That the unknown, the iyadhyā, is around there somewhere. It is painful to us to be in tayas automati. We feel it painful. Why do we feel it painful? Because we're not entirely in tayas automati. We're not 100% there. If we were 100% there, we wouldn't have any pain. We wouldn't notice it. We'd be in a robot. We would be automat. We're not 100%. We're 90%. We're not 100% there. And that's our Buddha nature. That's where we have a window to something which is not constructed. And that's our, in a way, opportunity. So the fact is that we feel something missing in our life. What's missing is us, really. Is another view of us. We miss the reality. We miss something beyond. And so therefore we come to practice. So let's talk about what we do with practice in terms of sankharas. Firstly, if we, instead of just staying with Plato's cave and seeing the shadows, we start to explore the cave, the galot, to explore the cave and explore the shadows in the cave. And if we explore the shadows, we can begin to understand that they are shadows. The first thing is to explore the fact and realize that they're shadows. That's a very big step. But it's what your homework was last couple of weeks ago. It's exactly that. Remember, wait a minute, like Carmel's story about the computer. I can look at things less fixed. At the beginning, it was fixed. I had a problem. The computer didn't work. I had a struggle. I'm against. The computer is a thing. It should work. I had expectations and so on, etc. The farek, this fixation, based on tendencies of greed, hate and illusion. I want, I don't want, and I don't know. I'm confused. So, based on that, we build a picture, we sustain samsara, or we can begin to explore the situation. And it's not so clear when we explore the situation. We somehow begin to get a feeling that we are making this world, that we seem to be fixed. It's not 100% fixed. We seem to be making this world. Most of us do it with mental objects. We do it with physical objects, but we also do it quite a lot with mental objects. Vipassana is about this. It's about seeing any of the four foundations, but seeing any of them that we previously thought was reality, seeing them that it's not so clear anymore that it's reality, such as a narrative, judgment, which we believe, we grow up, we act in life, we struggle with it, and so on. All of a sudden we sit down, go on retreat, and we see, wait a minute, this narrative is actually not 100% true. It's just a narrative that I am making. It doesn't have inherent reality other than what I gave it. I build it, I sustain it, and if I just relax, stop sustaining it, stop building it, and stop believing it, it goes away. Means it never had reality in the first place. Otherwise that wouldn't go away. But we see it does go away. If we stop believing, stop sustaining, stop in the cycle of samsara, it goes away. therefore it never really existed in the first place. It's just a construction that we made. Part of this is exploring subject and object. I wrote it here in my comment here. Explore apparent subject and object, and close the gap between subject and object. One of the ways in which the illusion of a fixed world that we make is sustained is by duality. Duality is a separation of me and the world, and it sustains this illusion. I am here as a fixed thing called the subject, there is the world as a fixed thing called object, and the two are fixed in some kind of a fixation, sankhara. If we begin to play with this, things get less fixed. The subject and the object don't need to sustain each other in the same way. Krishnamurti said, the whole tragedy of human existence lies between the subject and the object.
Can you elaborate when you were looking at that? Can you elaborate a little more?
Yeah, because when we build an observer all the time, and the observer is known, ki'ilu, me, I know myself, I am me, I believe that I exist as an observer, I look at the world through the filter of my memory, my biography, my story, my tendencies, my tavniot, my filter, because the masach called me. That's fixed. The world is fixed in the same way. My memory, what I learnt in university, what I know, what my neural networks say. So the separation of subject and object tends to fix things as known, observer and observed. As soon as they begin to come together, it's no longer so clear what is known. The subject isn't clear and the object is not clear, because they're more like dancing together. That, for example, I suppose the word that you can use here is intimacy, which is in the Dharma exploration of tree, the intimacy means it's not so clear what is tree, what is me. There is less fixation when things come together. There is less gap. There is a sense of life. Life can get in there, because the duality tends to hold things.
We're the subject.
Yes.
You don't let other things be the subject.
Yes. In the end, through the world can seem like universal subject or universal object. Everything can be subject, or everything can be object. But it breaks it down. The duality, maybe the way the mind works and the way sankhara works and the way karma works, is the duality holds things in their place. Like there's a famous story of one of the 64 siddhas, who are Indian sadhus or Indian sages that went to Tibet and started Tibetan Buddhism. Because Tibetan Buddhism came from Indian wild Indian sadhus, really. They're not Buddhists so much. But one of them came over to Tibet, and he went to his teacher and he said, I have pain, physical pain from a thyroid problem, a goiter here, and it's terrible pain. And the teacher said, stay with the pain and come back in a year. And he was very shocked. He said, what, that's spiritual practice? Staying with the pain? I thought spiritual practice meant to be getting rid of pain. No, stay with the pain. So he stayed with the pain and he came back in a year, and the teacher said, how is your pain? And he said, it's terrible. It fills my whole existence. I'm with it morning and noon and night. It's terrible. It's overwhelming. The teacher said, good. Now, practice that this pain is not only filling you, it fills the whole world. So he went away for another year and he came back and he said, and he was awakened, enlightened by the universal, the subject becoming universal subject. So beyond the self into the whole universe became self. So dissolving, therefore, the self and the world just dissolved. So one of the things that we do in practice is dissolve or deconstruct sankharas. Then it's what we do without maybe calling it this language, but it is actually what we do. Every time we come out of the automat of, well, think, like, use the example of pain. I have a pain in my back. That's very fixed. Pain in my back, I have to shut it up with Akamol, I have to stop it, I have to fight it, I don't like it, I must deal with it, it's there all the time, and I suffer. That's a very fixed situation. As soon as we begin to turn towards it, with the eye of mindfulness, and look at it as it really is, the duality of me as a sufferer and the pain as a thing that I have to fight is dissolving. It's not so clear anymore, me as a sufferer, I'm a watcher, I'm a witness, I am curious about it, I am with it, I am a mother, my heart is with it, I'm a mother of myself, I embrace it. So the me, sankhara of me, softens, begins to melt, becomes rich, not just closed, becomes a wider thing. The many kinds of me that's there, looking at the pain, and the pain becomes many kinds of pain. It's spreading, it's moving, it's changing, it's interesting, it's not interesting, it's sharper, it's duller. It may be pleasure inside there, which I didn't think of before. Maybe it, and it goes away, and it comes back, and it disappears. And the whole thing becomes a much more dynamic, less constructed field of change. Me and the pain breaks into multiple compounded things, and that was the famous Buddhist, you know, quote that I gave in the meditation. All compounded things are impermanent, passing, free. They're made of other things. So I want to read to you a quote, a very nice story. It's in a sutta about the lute. The lute is the oud, a musical instrument called the oud, right? And in English it's lute. And it's the same, it's like guitar. So I'll read you the sutta. Suppose there were a king or a king's minister who had never heard the sound of a lute before, of an oud. He might hear the sound of a lute and say, oh, what, my good men, is that sound? It's so delightful. It's so tantalizing. It's so intoxicating. It's so beautiful. It's so thrilling. And they would say, that, sir, is called a lute. whose sound is so delightful, so tantalizing, so intoxicating, so beautiful, so thrilling. And he would say, oh, go and fetch me that lute. And they would fetch the lute and say, here, sir, is the lute, whose sound is so delightful, intoxicating, tantalizing, beautiful, thrilling. And he would say, no, 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 enough of your lute. Fetch me just the sound. Then they would say, this lute, sir, is made of numerous components, a great many components, a great many markivim. It is through the activity of numerous components that the lute sounds. That is, the sound is dependent on the body, the skin, the neck, the frame, the strings, the bridge, and the appropriate human effort. And so it is that this lute that is made of numerous components, a great many components, sounds through the activity of numerous components. And then the king would split the lute into 10 pieces, into 100 pieces, and having split the lute into 10 pieces or 100 pieces, he would shave it into little splinters, and shaving it into splinters, he would burn it in a fire, and having burnt it in a fire, he would reduce it to ashes, and then having reduced it to ashes, he would throw it before a high wind, or let it be washed away in a swift flowing stream. And he would say, a sorry thing, this lute, whatever this lute really is, it's a sad thing, by which people have been so thoroughly tricked and deceived all this time. And in this way, a monk investigates form and fabrications, means sankharas. However far form goes, he will investigate it. So it's a powerful image. Anything that we come up with is that lute, that oud, a thing made of numerous components, and we're the king, right? And in this story, the king says, I've been tricked. The lute is just a fiction. I've been thoroughly tricked. There isn't such a thing as lute. It's just a spell we've been put on ourselves. It's like a spell, like a kind of kesem. And lute isn't. It's all made of numerous things, and the sound comes out, and we are delighted and thrilled with the sound. You know, that's the three poisons, or one poison, namely chukka. I love it, I want it, and therefore the lute, I want the lute, and I need it, and there is a lute, and it's a thing, and I have it, and it's so delightful, and everyone's in a spell. That the lute is the thing that is delighting us. There isn't a lute, it's a million things making this sound that we get attached to. So, it very much invites us, first of all, to take to pieces all compounded things, to not to give anything priority, control over us, reality, absolute reality. To be equanimous, namely, just because the lute is thrilling and exciting, or the pain feels very strong or dynamic or controlling, to be equanimous meaning to take down from our obsession with pain and pleasure, and therefore allowing things to be more what they are instead of what we want them to be. Therefore, not sustaining sankharas through our interest in what we want or what we don't want. It's sustained by our interest, desire, and aversion. Sustains this duality of the world as it is. And as we do that, things get calmer, things get quieter. We actually, many of us, we feel intuitively, and it's the, you know, the karma of our natural Buddha nature that's also there, that we feel intuitively we are disturbed. We are agitated, isheket, by this duality of the world all the time being what it is, being an illusion, not knowing what it is, but being controlled by the illusion of things. And so we want to quieten down and calm down and cool down. Nirvana means cooling. We want to cool down. And we begin to realize that calming down doesn't mean stopping, but it means being less believing in things that we think the way they ought to be. Stopping believing, but not being, let me say this again differently. Calming is being in the middle of the world and not shutting the world out, but being in the middle of the world without having all the time to construct things. And we find a natural calming, which is not stopping, not pushing away, and not shutting away, and not closing the doors. Well, we do it a little bit in a retreat. We do withdraw a bit because it's helpful to us, just to turn down the volume. But in the end, calm and peace comes from being in the middle of the world, not running away from it, but not seeing it as so constructed. All the constructions, sankharas, make us agitated, because we feel controlled by things, which we make the things, and they control us. So it's like a cycle. When we feel less controlled and less controlling and less obsessing and less building, we just simply feel more calm. But the life carries on. It's not that we stop anything. The image that came to me some time back is when I was watching kids playing in the sand, was that our life is a little bit like kids playing in a kufsa chol, in a sandbox. And we don't know that we're playing in a sandbox. We're just playing, and we play with the toys, and we play in the kufsa chol, we play with the sand. And we don't know we're in a box. And actually, a very strong picture came to me once on a long retreat, that we're in like in a sandbox. We don't know it's a box. And the first thing that happens when we start to practice is we begin to get a feeling that we're in a box. We're suffering. We are in some prison of these constructions, these sankharas. They're imprisoning us. Like I said before, a narrative that imprisons us, a narrative in the mind that holds us and makes us suffer. So we see we're in prison, we're in a box. When we allow our awareness to expand, we see we're in a box, we can begin to see that there are walls in the box, but we can see outside, that there is a place beyond the box that we never realized before, because we were so totally inside the box. The sand, playing with the toys. Suddenly we see, wait a minute, the world isn't like that. There is a space outside the box. And we can feel outside, and we can see that the door is open. We actually can go out. We don't need to be in this box. And when we go out, we realize that there was no box. That we made it in the first place. That the walls in the sandbox are us. They don't really exist. Only when we go out we realize we made them. We thought they existed before, but they don't exist. And it's in these constructions, by the way, that it's one of the best places for us to work. In Paticca-samuppada, the 12 links, there are places which are easier for us to work spiritually and in our meditation practice or in our life practice, and this is one of them. It's easier to, because the sankharas oppress us and make us suffer. And because it's quite easy to see, well, wait a minute, this thing isn't so solid, this pain is not so solid as I thought before. It doesn't need so much practice for this. It's quite easy, relatively. It's one of the places in the 12 stations of Paticca-samuppada that's easy to work with. There are others that are not easy, but this one is. And that's where a lot of the Vipassana practice is about deconstructing sankharas that we previously thought was solid, we previously thought we were in the box, but looking again and again and again and seeing, well, we can actually be outside the box. So it's quite an it's one of the places that we do work. And so I want to finish with kind of reading a quote. I wonder if I've got it here. What's it really like outside the box? Yeah, I'll have a look at it. Maybe I've got it here, maybe not. And it, well, just a minute. After. Yeah, hints of beyond. I'll give you a few hints of beyond, which from the words of the Buddha, from other teachers, just allow this to confuse us, okay, and to give us a hint of the unknown. So it's a quote from the Buddha: where neither solidity, fluidity, heat, nor motion means the elements, the four elements, solid, earth, fluid, water, heat, or motion, find any footing, they cannot hold us. And there no sun, moon, or star ever shines. There is neither any light, yet nor is there any darkness. When a practitioner, through stilling of all construction, all sankhara, through quietening of all mental formations, directly experiences this, then he is freed from both form and formlessness. He is released from control by both pleasure and all pain. And from a Tibetan text, all that is, all that exists, has universal, well, he actually says, has me, but he doesn't define me as a person. Me is universal creativity, pure and total presence. All this has me, means universal creativity, pure and total presence, as its root. How things appear is my being. How things arise is my manifestation. Sounds and words heard are my messages expressed in sounds and words. All the capacities, the forms and awarenesses, the bodies of all beings, the way they live and so on, all environments, all beings, all life forms, all experiences are nothing other than the primordial state, the original state of pure and total presence. It's a kind of a sense of what things look like when the sankharas are not believed in anymore. Okay, so let's take a moment of contemplation.